Thanks, Bill, for that unique and personal introduction. Just to point up a couple things that Bill kind of touched on, the reason you should listen to what I have to say today about Latin America is because 28 years ago I began as Vice President Bush's Deputy Foreign Policy Advisor in the Reagan administration, working principally, or importantly, on Latin America, became the Director for Latin American Affairs on the National Security Council, later was the Executive Secretary of the National Security Council, later the Managing Director of the Council of the Americas for its Washington office, which is the business association of large companies that invest in Latin America. I've worked on the U.S.-Colombia business partnership. I've headed the U.S.-Bolivia business partnership. I'm a senior associate at the Americas program of CSIS, and I've worked on Latin America for the better part of 30 years. That said, it's largely a mystery to me what goes on there, but I will try to discuss it with you today. I should say, by way of preface, that when I came to my first Philadelphia Society meeting in 1993, I was, from that very first day, confident that eventually I would be accorded the honor and distinction and supreme pleasure of being someday before the Society to make an introduction, or to make a presentation, because I was also confident that sooner or later some illustrious and learned scholar whose views and research would be truly worthy of your attention would have some mishap or strain of fetlock and have to scratch, and some humble policy practitioner and commentator whose subject matter might, you know, be plausibly related to the original topic would be asked to step in, and that guy might be me. That is, in fact, what happened, and I thank Bill very much for the invitation to address you. A month ago, Tom Shannon, the Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, the senior-most official responsible for the hemisphere, was giving a speech at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. It's a place I know we're all familiar with since we all hang out there a lot. It was a lot like a speech he gave 3 days earlier at the Heritage Foundation. That may be a little bit more familiar to you all. He emphasized the positive agenda that we enjoyed with our hemispheric neighbors, supporting democracy, fighting poverty together, alternative development programs, the various free trade agreements either recently ratified or pending ratification with Peru, Colombia, Panama, our cooperative relationship with Brazil. It was described by a friend of mine as the most conciliatory speech on Latin America that Shannon had given yet, and he's given a long string of them. It was almost as if problems like Venezuela, Bolivia, and so forth were not really almost on the radar screen. In the middle of his remarks, Tom's principal deputy, Charles Shapiro, caught his eye and gestured to him importantly and got him to check his BlackBerry, where there he read the news that Bolivia's President Evo Morales had just announced in a speech that he was expelling the American ambassador. On Monday of this week, the week we're in, that bastion of faithful conservatism and staunch anti-communism and anti-socialism, the stridently anti-socialist Washington Post, editorialized on Latin America. I don't know if you saw it. Let me read a few lines from its editorial. With U.S. attention fixed elsewhere, significant parts of Latin America continue to march away from the Washington consensus of democracy and market capitalism that has governed the region for a generation. The latest step came last week in Ecuador, where voters approved a new constitution that concentrates power in the hands of Rafael Correa. In addition to Ecuador, Hugo Chavez's satellites now include Nicaragua, Bolivia, and Cuba. Honduras and Paraguay may be swinging his way. Most are moving to embrace 20th century economic policies that the world outside Latin America almost universally recognizes as unworkable, like state takeovers of industries. The Bush administration has struggled for years with the question of how to respond to these developments. For the most part, it has chosen to sidestep Mr. Chavez's provocations, calculating that his regime will eventually self-destruct, a bet that looks better with each drop in the price of oil. But rulers such as Morales and Chavez and Nicaragua's Daniel Ortega should not be allowed to dismantle democratic institutions and attack U.S. interests while benefiting from American subsidies. Sooner or later, they must be forced to choose between Mr. Chavez's half-baked socialism and the democracy of the 21st century. Well, when the Washington Post writes things like that, you know that conditions are becoming bad. Nowadays, and for the last several years, longtime U.S. Latin America watchers, especially ones of our persuasion, have been asking themselves the same question that stock market watchers have been asking themselves for the last several weeks. What happened? Today, it's my job to explain. To do that, I need to cover, in a few minutes, about 30 years of Latin American history. We won't go back to the 16th century, but we will go back to the 1980s. Basically, the last 30 years can roughly be parceled out in three almost decade-long periods. The 1980s, the period of democratization. The 1990s, which I think of as a period of consolidation. And the current decade, which I think of as a period of disintegration. Let's start with the first, democratization in the 1980s. In 1986, about two-thirds of the way or three-quarters of the way through his administration, President Reagan held a summit meeting in the island of Grenada, which he had liberated just a couple years earlier from essentially a Cuban-sponsored government. The main props he used for his meeting were two color-shaded maps of Latin America and the Caribbean, one showing the democratic countries when he took office, the other showing the democratic countries at that moment. The first map highlighted, well, really, a very small club. Venezuela, Colombia, and Ecuador may also have included Peru because Peru was transitioning to democracy just about as President Reagan was being elected. Costa Rica and Mexico, which we counted as a democracy because even though it was one-party rule, there was actually elections and they changed leaders as a result of the elections. And the Dominican Republic. And of course, the islands of the English-speaking Caribbean, except Grenada, even though a couple of them had had, you know, close blushes or brushes with Cuban communism. The second map showed every country in the Western Hemisphere turned democratic except Cuba, Nicaragua, Chile, Paraguay, and Suriname. By that time, Duvalier had fled Haiti, and Forbes Burnham had died in Guyana, and so we were maybe a little bit over-optimistic about how things would turn out there. Reagan might have sensed with his characteristic optimism, but he couldn't have known that a little over 3 years later, even Chile, Paraguay, and Nicaragua would pass from dictatorships to democracy, leaving only Cuba. The wave of democratization that began at the end of the 1970s and continued through the 1980s was due to several factors, obviously. Jimmy Carter's human rights policy, naive and myopic, nevertheless helped delegitimize and weaken a number of dictatorial regimes. Military governments in many places had played themselves out and reached economic cul-de-sacs where it was necessary to simply turn over and leave. In another case, Alex's native Argentina, an adventurous bid to get a new lease on life for a military dictatorship, a reckless war with Britain over the Falkland Islands, turned out disastrously militarily, and the junta had to go. But the most consistent and constant influence for democracy, steadily gathering strength as the 80s wore on, was Ronald Reagan's Democracy Initiative, distilled and enunciated in his 1982 Westminster Address. There were, of course, other aspects to the Reagan administration's Latin America policy. It had an important security component. We saw that in Central America in the fight to save Salvador from communism and reclaim Nicaragua. It had an important counter-narcotics component. It had very important economic components, the Caribbean Basin Initiative, the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement, which later was expanded by George Bush to be NAFTA, including Mexico, and saving Mexico from its 1982 credit crisis. Crudely put, speaking about the Reagan administration's Latin America policy, one could say that the Reagan administration was able to walk and chew gum at the same time with respect to Latin America policy, even while its main energies were directed to reviving the U.S. economy and winning the Cold War. Does that verdict invite any more recent comparisons? Unfortunately, the fledgling Latin American democracies of the 1980s proved all too often economically vulnerable. A number of them, many of them, succumbed to hyperinflation, and at least two democratically elected presidencies, the presidency of Alfonsín in Argentina, the presidency of Hernán Siles in Bolivia, had to be cut short, actually, by economic crises that were beyond their capacity to solve. Bolivia, by the way, we were speaking about runaway inflations. Bolivia had the highest inflation rate in, I think, in recorded history at 25,000% per year at one stage in the 1980s before that inflation was successfully tamed by the shock treatment administered by Planning Minister Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada under the tutelage of Jeff Sachs in the mid-80s. The economic vulnerabilities of the fledgling democracies of Latin America really dictated the obvious imperative for the next stage of Latin America's democratic development, and that is a process of economic consolidation. By various accounts, there was a convergence of thought on the part of mainly Western-educated, technocratic Latin American leaders and economic managers, leaders at international financial institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, the Inter-American Development Bank, and the U.S. Treasury, that was distilled into a policy paper that was called, somewhat regrettably, the Washington Consensus. There were 10 points to the Washington Consensus, and I won't read them all out, but there's a very short summary that I think is worth quoting. There were three main thrusts to the Washington Consensus. The first was the importance of achieving macroeconomic stability and taming inflation through the control of fiscal deficits. The second was the dismantling of protectionism and opening up to foreign trade, competition, and investment. And the third, reforming the role of the state in the economy and promoting the role of markets in allocating resources and generating wealth. That meant getting the government out of producing goods through privatization. That's a pretty congenial agenda on the whole from most of our points of view. The Washington Consensus found practical policy, manifested in practical policy. In the U.S., in the Brady Plan, which successfully relieved a great deal of debt burden for Latin American countries. In 3 years, the Brady Plan refinanced about $191 billion in Latin American debt through 18 separate deals, $61 billion of which ended up being forgiven. And through the Bush administration's, the George H.W. Bush administration's initiative, it was called the Enterprise for the Americas Initiative, which was intended to incentivize liberalized trade, incentivize reform through access to infrastructure funds, and of course relieve debt through the Brady Plan. That initiative was of course really formalized at the 1994 Miami Summit of the Americas under President Clinton, and took the form of the Free Trade Area of the Americas Initiative. Let's negotiate a free trade area from the Straits of Alaska to Tierra del Fuego. There was more too. Of course, there was also, by the way, an agreement at Miami that later became the U.S.-Chile Free Trade Agreement to include Chile and NAFTA. The Miami Summit, of course, had more economic dimensions than just the FTAA. We conceived the idea of a hemispheric finance ministerial to liberalize and unify Western Hemisphere capital markets, and the Hemispheric Energy Initiative. Sounds like an interesting idea now, doesn't it? To develop a hemispheric energy strategy. But the energy strategy idea quickly broke down between the constitutional restrictions and political sensitivities of countries in Latin America on opening their petroleum sectors to foreign participation. Mexico was, of course, the most sensitive on that point. And the Clinton Energy Department's determination to turn this into an environmental exercise. And the finance initiative began late, foundered on the political distractions of Clinton's second term. The Bush administration, Bush 1 administration, the Clinton administration also had other strings to their Latin America policy bows. Counter-narcotics thrust of the Bush administration's policy that brought us the Andean Trade Preference Act, which has just been renewed for another 6 months to tide Colombia and some of the other countries over while we're waiting ratification of the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. For Clinton, of course, his intervention in Haiti and his rescue plan for Colombia stand out. But increasingly, beyond these country-specific crises reactions, U.S. Latin America policy in the 1990s, and even into the first years of this decade, I think became more and more one-dimensional and reductionist and formulaic. Our policy became to promote the FTAA. Every bureaucrat in Washington, if you ask what was our Latin America policy, it was the FTAA. But the point of all of these emphases on trade liberalization, the free trade areas and the like, the underlying point was to solidify and reinforce the sweeping economic reforms that were being undertaken in almost all of the Latin American democracies and that covered the main points of the Washington consensus that I just summarized. Alex Chafuen and Jose Luis Sardón in our session earlier this morning, I think brilliantly encapsulated in just a few words some of the achievements of those reforms, and I won't go over them now. But there were real results. In Argentina, for example, under the reforms of the Menem administration, it succeeded to cut its poverty rate from 41.4% in 1990 to 21.6% in 1994. Other countries achieved similar and less spectacular results. One, if I might say, and I'll just toss this out to the academics and researchers in the audience, you know, one highly worthwhile and commendable research project that urgently needs to be taken up by scholars of our persuasion is to document the economic achievements of what's been maligned as neoliberalism in the 1990s. To counter and dispel the myths turned reality through repetition that this was a period of unemployment, grinding poverty, exploitation, and corruption. No period in history is free of problems, but it was exactly the opposite of all those things. But those who have the microphone have dominated the debate, and largely the defenders of the record of the 90s have been silent or silenced. There were, of course, dislocations that came from the reforms of the 90s. Argentina cashiered at least 100,000 public workers, but with no noticeable diminution in the quality of public service. In 1990, for example, we were just talking about this morning with Carl Zeebarth, the Argentine railroads employed 98,000 people, but half of their locomotives were not serviceable, just to pick a random example. On the flip side of those dislocations, though, there were injections of private investment that made possible spectacular economic achievements that would have taken decades or longer for the old parastatals to achieve if they would ever have been able to do so. Thanks to foreign investment, for example, Bolivia, in less than a decade, tripled from about 17 trillion cubic feet of proven and probable reserves of natural gas to about roughly in the vicinity of 50 trillion cubic feet proven and probable reserves. That made it possible for Bolivia, a landlocked and very poor country, to actually execute and, for a time, fulfill long-term gas supply agreements with Brazil's eastern industrial cities. So successful was Venezuela's auction to foreign producers of exploration partnerships in marginal and abandoned fields in the 1990s that as recently as 3 years ago, after the mismanagement of Venezuela's state-owned oil company PDVSA by Chavez and the large-scale cashiering of its professional managers and engineering staff after the 2002 strike, 3 years ago, it was those foreign concessions operating marginal fields, not PDVSA's company-owned fields, that produced the lion's share of Venezuela's oil liftings. Private investment funded the development of an emerging Latin South American gas grid, an advantage that North America as a continent has enjoyed over South America for most of the 20th century through, among other projects, the construction of the Bolivia to Brazil pipeline. So now here we are, near the end of the first decade of the 21st century, and we look back on the achievements of the decade of democratization in the 80s, the decade of reform and consolidation in the 90s. And as we survey the wreckage of the last 8 or 9 years, with several hostile governments espousing 21st century socialism fomenting burgeoning relations with China, Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah, with new regional groupings like Chavez's Bolivarian Alternative Economic Group, participated in, incidentally, by Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and Dominica, as far as I recall, and Cuba, of course. And the UNASUR, Union of South American States, that's just been formed, Brazil's project for a South American Defense Council, all of which pointedly exclude the United States, I think we have a right to ask, what went wrong? How did this happen? Broadly speaking, I think there are three root explanations, and they're pretty simple. Bad luck, bad politics, and bad actors. Bad luck. In the 1990s, and Alex covered this, I think, brilliantly in a very short form, just when things were starting to get good, they got very bad. The 1997-98 baht-yuan crisis in Asia, followed closely by Russia's debt default, choked off investment and credit for emerging markets all around the world and produced a profound recession in Latin America. Growth dropped to zero. In some cases, it was negative. Some countries actually slipped into recession. Some, like Bolivia, never actually experienced negative growth. But the drop from the heady growth rates of the early to mid-90s down to zero or very slow growth hit very hard. It felt like a recession, and opposition politicians played this for all it was worth. Second, bad politics. By now, we should all have learned to never underestimate the perversity and atavism of politics and politicians, at home or in Latin America. Even before the recession that launched Latin America into its current decade of traditional social democrat or paternalistic, clientelistic politicians in various countries, Bolivia is my favorite example, were denouncing the 1990s reforms as corrupt, as selling out the country to foreigners, as heartless and savage impositions of the market on the poor and unemployed. Those were principally an argument for not doing what our opponents wanted to do when they were in office, but to put us back in office so we can do what we want to do. Oh, and by the way, get our friends and our own noses in the public trough. Latin America's chronic corruption, still largely unfazed, even by promising initiatives like the 1990s Inter-American Convention Against Corruption, provided a fertile breeding ground for those charges. They were all perfectly believable, after all, in societies with pretty endemic corruption. So that created, I think, a very fertile ground for discrediting the reforms of the 90s. Short-term thinking was another main feature, I guess, of main manifestation of bad politics. For example, in Argentina, President Menem's decision to abandon fiscal discipline in his last year in office, even in the face of the Asian and Russian financial crises, in an effort to buy his way to a third term through inflationary spending, combined with his successor's brittle and rigid and unimaginative adherence to $1-to-$1 convertibility for almost 2 years after Argentina's biggest trading partner, Brazil, already devalued its currency, doomed Argentina to one of the worst economic collapses ever recorded in December of 2001, and ushered in, by way of a few revolving door presidencies in the interim, the erratic populism and U.S. baiting of Nestor and Cristina Kirchner, one of the more unique husband and wife political acts in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, they're more successful at this point with the husband and wife routine than Bill and Hillary Clinton. Another example of bad politics, Alemán in Nicaragua's compact with Ortega to lower the first round vote threshold to win the presidency in exchange for protection against prosecution. Kind of raises that question for politicians. You know, what's more important, democracy and freedom, or staying out of jail so that you can enjoy your ill-gotten gains? If that's the dominant question, well, if you're the politician who has the capacity to deliver constitutional change, you know, is there much choice? Regional opportunism is another example of bad politics at work. For instance, in the current moment, Brazil and Venezuela are competing for regional leadership in a field from which the U.S. is largely sidelined. And Brazil clearly sees a wide open opportunity to grasp a decades-long goal, to set itself up as the leader of a South American bloc and be a rival or counterpart of the U.S., which would be leading sort of a North American bloc. But it would not, the U.S. would then not be leading a unified hemisphere. With that prize at stake, and with the regional leaders signing up with alacrity to the idea of this new UNASUR, It's scarcely surprising that its first emergency meeting a few weeks ago in Santiago, actually last month, produced wholehearted support for Evo Morales' government in Bolivia and no comfort for those who were seeking to resist his efforts to constitutionalize dictatorship, a point on which Alex quoted Oscar Ortiz, the president of the Senate, this morning, as a friend of mine had put it. What's more important in this case, real democratic governments or recruiting others to further your regional ambitions? Well, if you're Brazil, you know, in that trade-off, real democratic governance might take a back seat. In my analysis, bad luck contributed to the economic downturn and the crises in Latin America 7 to 9 years ago that provided the fertile ground for what's happened. Bad politics in the 90s have helped discredit reforms and the reformers and hastened and worsened the economic crises while scapegoating the results on the 90s reformers. But what that's really set the stage for is the third cause, bad actors. Chavez is a bad actor. Morales is a bad actor. We knew they were bad actors before they ever ran for the presidency. Chavez tried twice to overthrow the government of Venezuela by military coup. Morales has been the leader of the coca growers movement in Bolivia and fomented, the overthrow of two presidents, Goni Sanchez de Lozada and his successor, Carlos Mesa, and crimped, importantly, the government of Hugo Mansur before him. Fernando Correa, the current president of Ecuador, when he was finance minister, engineered the confiscation of Occidental Petroleum's properties there in a clearly populist move. These are not good people. The difficulty is that we don't have very good formulas for coping with, dealing with, isolating, defeating bad actors. In fact, I was making a presentation. I'm going a bit over time here. I apologize for that. I got going a bit later than I expected. I was giving a presentation last week at a thing called the U.S.-Peru Investment Forum, 08, in Washington. And I was on a panel with a guy named Michael Shifter, who some of you may know from the Inter-American Dialogue, and with two other Democrats. So you can see it was fair and balanced. And as Shifter and several of the other speakers before him, a former U.S. ambassador under Clinton to Chile and Peru's current ambassador to Washington were speaking, it all of a sudden hit me that there is an epistemological difference between left and right and liberals and conservatives when it comes to analyzing what's happening in Latin America. It has a sort of an automotive metaphor to it, and I like metaphors. Both sides agree that social movements or social sectors are the motor behind Latin America's recent social and political changes and upheavals. But to continue the automotive metaphor, conservatives tend to think that it's the driver, not the motor, that determines where the car is going and where it ends up. Liberals somehow seem to think that the motor determines where the car is going and where it ends up, or, better yet, that somehow the motor determines what kind of driver steps into the driver's seat and what destination he heads off in. It's a very strange way of thinking to me. It's probably something that deserves more exploration. But regardless of what determines Latin American nations' direction and destination now and who's in the driver's seat, the region has had a pretty good ride for the last 5 years. After a fairly speedy recovery from the crises of 99 to 2002, the region's been averaging growth, I believe, of around 7%. It's been buoyed by high world prices for its primary products, oil, gas, minerals, timber, and helped along by the haircut that was enforced on creditors, for example, on defaulted Argentine loans, as well as on the assets that have been taken from foreign investors by Chavez and Morales and the Kirchners, and Ecuador, for that matter, during Correa's stint as finance minister. But the growth that these countries are experiencing masks a number of underlying weaknesses. Economic policies, like proposing to hike taxes on Argentina's agricultural exports, are becoming increasingly irrational. Without foreign investment Oil and gas production has been declining in Venezuela, Argentina, and Bolivia, to the point that Argentina, since last year, could no longer fulfill its gas supply contracts to Chile, and Bolivia can't fulfill its gas supply commitments to Brazil. It also masks gross economic mismanagement. In the midst of a soaring world oil prices of the last 2 years, Venezuela's poverty rate has been rising. That's a little counterintuitive. But whatever the causes and whatever the effects, we're less than a month from a U.S. presidential election. We're about 3 months from inaugurating a new U.S. administration. We're in the midst of the worst financial crisis and economic crisis in 80 years that tends to discredit, in the popular mind, the reputation of capitalism and markets as fast as it's dissipating assets and wealth. And we're facing a number of anti-American socialist regimes in Latin America that at least will indulge themselves in Schadenfreude. So what do we do? I have a list of 7 recommendations, and with this I will close. First, be realistic. Unless the financial crisis is remarkably short-lived and markets rebound quickly, domestic and global economic conditions will both crimp our possibilities and absorb political management attention indefinitely. Also, achieving results that we would otherwise consider positive from an Obama administration will be much more improbable than from a McCain administration, just by instinct and orientation. That argues for keeping expectations low and picking your targets and goals carefully. Second, remember that the 90s, when we enjoyed warm relations with almost every country in the Western Hemisphere, except Cuba, when we were all, so to speak, on the same policy page, were the exception, not the rule. We kind of get spoiled by that. Usually, our relations with our hemispheric neighbors are patchy. Some good, some strained, some indifferent, just like they are now. Remember also that Latin America's left socialist regimes, they need enemies, they create enemies. And the U.S. is candidate number one to be the enemy, the scapegoat for your problems and failures. So don't take their insults and provocations personally. Certainly don't take them on board and give them legitimacy by acting as if they had validity. But also don't take it lying down either. That doesn't so much imply, I'm not meaning to imply, replying defensively and tit for tat on every allegation or slight, but I am implying to start counterpunching on issues on which those regimes are vulnerable, particularly on which they're vulnerable with their own domestic constituencies. Third, play for what's important. This means seeing Plan Colombia through to success, particularly now that President Uribe has the FARC guerrillas on the ropes, and persuading, cajoling, sandbagging, embarrassing, whatever it takes, the Democrats in Congress and the new administration into ratifying the U.S.-Colombia Free Trade Agreement as really it has economic importance, of course, but it's also about whether we validate and complete Plan Colombia or start to turn away from it. It may be wishful thinking, but ironically, it might be easier to ratify the Colombia FTA after the election. What else is important? Mexico is important to support President Calderon in his war with the drug gangs via the Merida Initiative, or some repackaged substitute for it. Chile and Peru are important. They're the bright spots. Chile's case, it's the one bright spot, basically, in the whole hemisphere. And Peru, thanks to the lurking around the edges of Ollanta Humala, who's been referenced already, is, I think, the next country at risk in the hemisphere. And Cuba, that's important, because there might be a historic opportunity for transition that will present itself unexpectedly. Fourth, try to revitalize the Organization of American States, despite Venezuela's commitment to paralyzing and neutering it. It's the most handy, ready-made antidote to the short-sighted, geopolitically inspired efforts to freeze us out of South American institutions and deliberations. Fifth, rearm ourselves with some potent implements in the battle of ideas and the struggle for freedom. First, here are 3 suggestions. Recreate USIA as a dedicated, public diplomacy agency to counter and combat hostile propaganda. Create, or cause to be privately created, a new organ in our arsenal of democracy-promoting agencies and organizations, one that's not so much aimed at helping countries transition from dictatorship to democracy, as practically all of our democracy-promoting machinery is, but one that looks backward and performs a sort of watchdog function, a whistleblower function, a best policies or best practices function. Is looking forward to how we help the next Tajikistan become a democracy, and none of it is focused on looking backward at who's just changed an important feature of the Constitution that will make it possible for Daniel Ortega to win elections indefinitely. We're just not doing that. We should. We should, I think, also, this is both controversial and encoded, we should rethink whether there are ways that minimizing the risk of backfire enable us to deal with the bad actor problem, either unilaterally or through coalitions or through proxies. Six, try to adopt a posture of nimble opportunism with respect to the region. We've got to maintain close and cooperative relations with countries that are receptive. We need to maintain correct relations with those that are hostile or indifferent. But we need to remember that all hostile leaders are practicing economic policies with a decades-long proven record of failure, making them potentially, unpredictably unstable. In a review, actually a review of the book that I just quoted a moment ago, Michael Reed's Forgotten Continent, Mark Falkoff predicted that all these proto-socialist governments would come to a bad end anyway. That's kind of the bet of the Bush administration, as I mentioned. But if the opportunity presents itself, maybe we should make sure that that happens. And since we are already pregnant, by the way, many times over in acquiescing to coups against democratically elected leaders, they have happened in a number of countries. We successfully prevented coups that overthrew legitimately elected governments in the 90s. But we've acquiesced in a number of such coups in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in Argentina, just to name three examples, in this decade. As long as the coups are by civilians and not military, and as long as they're covered by the fig leaf of constitutionalism, it seems to me we shouldn't be too squeamish about helping leaders like Morales and Chavez go the way that they prepared for their predecessors. And seven, don't discard the possibility that developments in the wider world, ranging from an adverse turn in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf and South Asian area, or the appearance of terror-related security threats from the South, a la Hezbollah and the new Iranian embassies that are cropping up in places like Nicaragua and Bolivia, may prompt us to, in effect, fall back on our own hemisphere and give new priority to the region. In this case, securing our southern flank might prove cheaper and easier in times of constrained possibilities than reshaping the Arab Islamic world. Thank you.